Hi, guys. Thank you for your continued support of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I also wanted to take a moment and thank two of our wonderful podcast sponsors. The first is Thrive Market. Thrive is a new online marketplace offering the world's best-selling natural and organic products at wholesale prices. If Costco and Whole Foods Online got together at a rave and got liquored up, their child would look a lot like Thrive Market. So the way that Thrive works, for less than $5 a month, about $59.95 annually, you get a membership that gives you access to more than 2,500 of the highest quality food, supplement, home, personal care, and beauty products. Those are all delivered straight to your door and at 25 to 50% below retail price. Orders above $49 are free, but that's only in the continental United States. RobWolf.com followers get a free two-month Thrive Market membership, as well as 20% off of your first order. So go to thrivemarket.com/Rob Wolf, and you can get in on that deal. Our second podcast sponsor is Hylete. Check out Hylete's innovative athletic apparel at Hylete.com. If you love Hylete, and I absolutely do, you can love a whole lot more of them, because if you enter the code ROBWOLF50, ROBBWOLF50, you receive a holy cat's worthy 50% off your purchase. Thank you again, and it's time for the show. Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Very excited for today's guest. He's a documentary filmmaker, very interesting background, and as of just today, although this show will be going up possibly a week later, Jared Stone is the author of Year of the Cow, How 420 Pounds of Beef Built a Better Life for One American Family. Jared, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's super stoked to have you on the show. Now, remind me, who put us in contact?
Right. You and I actually met via the Savory Institute.
That's right.
Yeah, my buddy Chris Kirsten, actually, in a former life, is the gentleman who was the rancher that I actually bought the cow from, like, several years ago. And so he and I have just stayed in touch. And then, our the Venn diagram of our interest overlaps pretty heavily. So I went to the Savory Institute conference in Chico and met you up there.
That's right. And I just got to see Chris this last weekend at Paleo FX. So,
oh, rad. Very cool.
Yeah. So worlds collide yet again.
I know, right? He's good people.
He is a super good dude. And, it's exciting for me in this paleo space, this ancestral health space, is really finally starting to get excited about sustainability and food sourcing and all that type of stuff. A good friend of mine, Dallas Hartwig, he actually had an interesting observation, which was that a lot of people that get into this ancestral health, evolutionary medicine story, typically they've got some health problems that they are trying to deal with on their own. And once they get those dealt with, then you start kind of looking outward, like you really have to take care of your own stuff. You know, you can't necessarily save the world if you have a ulcerative colitis so bad you need surgery, which is what my story was. But once you get that buttoned up, I think a lot of people start thinking about, like, oh, okay, what's next? What do I do to make things better for my kids and for the world around me and whatnot? And I'm curious, what was the impetus for you to get into this story? Like, why did you reach out to Chris? And let folks know a little bit about your general background. Like, you weren't like a rancher or a paleo zealot like myself and most of these other people. So what was the impetus for this, especially given your background in documentary filmmaking?
Yeah, well, actually, I kind of approached it from the opposite direction. I'm a television producer. That's my day job, and I was watching TV one day in my house, and I've got this massive, I'm a TV professional, so you have to have the nice set in your house. So I was watching my, my big sexy 1080p wall mounted monster of a television, and I was watching a food show. And I was watching this food show, and it occurred to me that I knew more about the TV that was hanging on my wall than I knew about the food that I was watching on that television. So rather, I knew more about my TV than I knew about the food, the material, the physical material that actually becomes me, that actually, it gets incorporated in my body and walks around and makes dumb jokes. So I thought to myself, that has to how can that be? How can it be the fact that I know more about television than I know more than I know about the food that goes into me? So I went ahead and I started researching it, and I started researching grass-fed beef and, you know, beef production. I started with beef because I'm a Kansas kid, you know, originally, and before I moved out here to LA. And you know, they do a lot of beef in the Midwest, and you know, there's we also are, you know, well steeped in the mythology of the wide open plains, and that's sort of, you know, where my heritage is. So I looked into beef first and learned a lot about beef, and then as I started learning about beef, I decided I would, you know, I really needed to get a grass-fed steer. And the idea was that I would buy this grass-fed steer. I don't really cook so much, or I didn't at the time. Now I sure do. But I would teach myself, you know, all about cooking and all about agriculture through the grass-fed steer. So I would make the best use of every part of this animal that I possibly could. So if I'm, you know, going to cook something with a chuck roast, you know, for example, what's the most chuck roastiest dish that I could possibly make with a chuck roast? And I researched the hell out of it, and I'd come up with an idea, and I'd make it. And, you know, a lot of times I was successful, and sometimes I wasn't. And I think about half the time, those are probably the better stories. and then through that, I also started researching, you know, how we came to be so dependent upon this, you know, industrial food system. So as I was looking into that, that led me to, you know, to ask the next, you know, the next iterative question, which is, how did we used to do it? And so as I looked into how we used to do it, I came across a lot of revelations about the way our food ways and the way our, you know, our institutional systems changed around World War II, and then the aftermath of that event. And then, you know, and then that started asking me, well, like, well, if we used to do agriculture differently, you know, how did we used to eat? And so then I started looking into the way people used to eat, and I came across the Weston A. Price Foundation, and then over time I started getting into that more and more, and then I came across your work, and everything clicked, and I was like, this makes some sense. And so I changed pretty radically the way I ate, and that changed pretty radically the way I felt, because, you know, back to what you were saying about your, you know, there's the ancestral health movement is just starting to, you know, draw the correlation between where their food comes from, and you know, in the similar situation, I started drawing a correlation on my end from, you know, I'm trying to get healthy here, and, you know, I'm part of an ecosystem too, just as these cattle are, you know, in an ideal situation, part of their ecosystem, I'm part of my ecosystem. And, you know, by looking at that ecosystem, it changed the way I, you know, the way I conduct my life.
Oh, that's so it incredible, powerful. It's fascinating because what you did, the process that you did, and I don't know if that was 2 years or 20 years. I'm assuming closer to 2 years, but that's a process of education that I and a lot of other folks, the Savory Institute, Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, Weston A. Price Foundation, struggle with constantly, to get folks thinking about the world that we live in today isn't necessarily the way that things have always been done. And similar to the, you know, the paleo diet story, it's not that we necessarily want to overly glamorize or you know, wax nostalgic about ways that have been, you know, the way that we've done things in the past, but there are some elements of our modern world, whether it's internet or social media or whatnot, that is looking kind of unsustainable from health and societal standpoints. Like it seems to be our rate of change is occurring at such a clip that people are finding themselves ill-suited to deal with that rate of change. And so we look back a little bit, but there's an amazing amount of pushback by just kind of asking the question, well, how did we sustainably raise food before the intensification process that occurred from the end of World War II forward and really took off in the 1970s with farm subsidies, you know? And so what, yeah. I'm curious, like, do you have like a 170 IQ, or are you just incredibly, you know, a precocious person, or how did you connect all those dots? I'm very fascinated.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I just I just read a lot and work hard, and you know I didn't do anything that anyone else couldn't do. I don't think I just made the decision to do it. But yeah, no, what blew me away is, you know, we've got you know, everybody knows about CAFO beef and the fact that, you know, so much of our agriculture comes from, you know, these confined animal feeding organizations confined animal feeding operations, I talk too fast sometimes. And so, you know, that really grew out of the fact that we had just a glut of nitrogen fertilizer after World War II. So after World War II, you had 10 nitrogen plants built in the United States. And nitrogen fertilizer, ammonium nitrate is an oxidizer. So you can use it in bombs, for example. If you put it with a fuel source, it'll infuse a lot of oxygen very quickly into the detonation, right? So we built these 10 ammonium nitrate plants, to bomb the Nazis. And it was, relatively successful. And then when the war ended, we had all these nitrate plants, and they were like, well, what are we going to do with these? We've got all these plants. We've got all this infrastructure that can make nitrate. What should we do with it? So the idea that came about was, well, if nitrogen is a required element for plants to grow. So what if we use this as a fertilizer? So that was really the beginning of a lot of the, nitrogen intensive fertilizer that started being put on a lot of crops, especially F1 hybrid feed corn, because it turned out what they were after in the 50s, what they started realizing was you can increase your yield per acre directly with directly in proportion to the amount of nitrogen you put onto the crops. So it turned into a situation where, well, let's add a whole hell of a lot more nitrogen and we'll get a whole hell of a lot more corn. And it sure did. The problem is there's several fold. Is one, if you add too much nitrogen, it turns into runoff and it pollutes lakes and rivers. The second thing that it does is nitrogen is a petroleum product. So when you have this, enormous nitrogen infrastructure, you have a lot of petroleum that's coming in to support that. And so that is why when sometimes people say that CAFO beef is a petroleum product, that's what they mean. Because that corn, that surplus of corn, they had to find something to do with it, and it had long been known that if you feed a lot of corn to cattle, you can fatten them up faster than you could if you raised them on grass. So people started moving their cattle off of, became a volume business. They started moving them off of pasture and into industrial feedlots where they could feed them, gigantic amounts of corn because they had so much corn, and corn was so incredibly cheap with the subsidies you mentioned in the 70s that it became, much, much quicker to bring them to market weight, and that led to a glut of super cheap beef, which is kind of what we're used to now.
Right. So I forget the exact numbers, but early 1900s, folks in the U.S. spent 40 to 60% of their income on food. Lots of places around the world still spend significantly higher percentages of their yearly income on food, but Americans spend about 12 to 14% now, I think.
Yeah, it's crazy low. It's crazy low. And that's because we've got that's because corn is so cheap, both because of the subsidies and both because of we overproduce so much of it. You look at the Midwest and, some gigantic, I think it's like 36% of all crops grown are corn, and most of that is feed corn. I mean, it's a gigantic amount. And then, it's remarkable. But we've also got, pushing us from behind, we've also got this myth of the American West. So we've got the cowboy. Because the other thing to consider was after the end of the Civil War, we had soldiers from both sides who went west, to some extent to escape, the bad memories of the fighting, and then to the other extent, out west it was still fairly, I won't say lawless, but it was, there was more opportunity in the West. And so you had this myth of the cowboy that was born. And so in a lot of ways, with the cowboy, you could have a man who lived by his own code, and you had a man who could make the most of his own life. And that became heavily enshrined in our idea of what it is to be an American. Frederick Jackson Turner put out a hypothesis that said that the frontier was the crucible in which immigrants were made into Americans. By going out into the frontier and living, this wide open free life, and the cattle were inextricably linked to that. That informed what it means to be an American. And so, in a lot of ways, we've come up believing that beef is our birthright, and that beef, is damn straight. It should be crazy cheap, and you should eat, it should be accessible. And the flip side of that is that we don't value it as much, I think. And it's too easy to remember that to forget that it was once an animal and, think of it as a product. And that's one thing that, when you buy the whole animal, you realize very quickly, no, this is an animal. That's a leg. That's, you can't have, 22 tri-tips because there's only one per side. You very much learn the scarcity and the sacrifice that happens to, so that your family could eat, a high quality, nutritious meal.
Right. Oh, it's amazing. And, it's interesting for me, this topic becomes very contentious almost regardless of kind of sociopolitical affiliation. If you tend to be more conservative, then you definitely buy into that kind of rugged individualism, you know, that I think kind of grew out of that frontier cowboy kind of perspective. If you're a little bit more on the eco-liberal side of things, then the CAFO food story is kind of horrifying. If you're a little bit libertarian-leaning and with some networked systems stories, then you're a bit appalled by the inputs of limited fossil fuels going into a very inefficient system. It looks very efficient from one perspective, but quite inefficient right. Another. What you're proposing here, I think will piss almost anybody off. Have you? What's the response been thus far? You know, the folks that I see that have reviewed the book, I would say, are pretty savvy folks. Like, they seem to think in a little bit of a both yeah. market centric, but also a global systems centric approach. You know, like Joel Salatin, I think is able to have a foot in both worlds, both thinking globally and how things network together, but also kind of a market orientation. Like, I don't see, I think that this is an incredibly important, incredibly powerful book, and it will piss a lot of people off. Like, what's going on that front?
Well, to some extent, if I'm pissing a lot of people off, I'm probably doing
something very well. Yes.
But on the other hand, I tried to steer clear of, you know, not to get too political, but one of the things I think we suffer from is there's a little bit of a, you know, in the media and in a lot of political discourse, there's a little bit of blind tribalism. So mm-hmm. because, you know, side A says this and I'm side B, I have to believe that side A is full of shit. And and vice versa. And so I tried to steer clear of a lot of that, because I don't think that nobody has a monopoly on honest to God truth. So I feel like the fact of the matter does industrial agriculture cause pollution problems? Sure, it does. Is it an inefficient way from an environmental perspective to take an animal that's, you know, built to eat the lawn, then raise essentially human food in the form of corn, and then truck it across country and then feed that to said animal? Is that inefficient from an environmental standpoint? Yes, it is. But at the same time, that animal is made to eat the lawn, so let the animal eat the lawn. But does that take longer from an economic perspective? So from an economic perspective, i.e. getting meat to market, is that less efficient? Well, yes, it is less efficient. But I think, you know, if you pit economy versus, you know, environment, it's kind of a false battle, because economy, you're speaking of, you know, allocation of natural resources, and environment, you're speaking of natural resources directly. So you have to have that conversation of, yes, even though economically it may be more efficient, environmentally the environmental side will have to win out. And also, you know, I wouldn't even posit that the economic side would definitely lose in that situation, because when you have grass-fed beef at this point in history, you have to charge a premium for it because it is a little, it does take longer to go to market. But at the same time, you know, when you're charging a premium for that, you're not charging that premium going to a bunch of middlemen. You're not sending it from the rancher to the CAFO to the processor to the middleman to the supermarket. You know, what you're having is you're paying a premium, but you're paying it to a guy. You know, you're paying it to your rancher, because that's generally the way you're going to buy your grass-fed beef. So it supports small businesses and it supports local communities, because these guys are generally small processors. These are not your, you know, gigantic agribusinesses that are producing most of this grass-fed beef. So you're really, you know, it's you. So yes, you're helping. So on the one hand, is, you know, the on one side of the political discourse might think I'm a green hippie who's going to wander around barefoot and unwashed and you know, preach the gospel of grass or pastured agriculture. But on the other side, you could argue that I'm supporting small businesses and I'm you know, encouraging people to get to know where their food comes from and get to know their local rancher and make sure the butcher down the street still has a job, because that's a hell of a trade, and it's one that we're losing, you know, fairly quickly.
Yeah, and maybe even another group to appeal to. I know a lot of the intensification of the food supply grew out of the Cold War and wanting to shore up the amount of food that we have, and that was when oil was very, very inexpensive. And even though we currently today are in a moment when oil is relatively inexpensive, it was almost three times more expensive a year ago today.
Right.
And there's every indication and potentiality that it could be six or eight times more expensive a year from now, which creates a When you have an energetic input that drives so much of our food supply, one could really make an argument that from like a national security standpoint, we should really have decentralized, robust, resilient systems, which means using as little oil inputs as possible to make that happen.
No doubt. Yeah, without question. And again, if you have a situation like that, you have by and large, it's still a niche product. And when you have, and I don't think it needs to be, I think this could, you know, when you have a high price for petroleum, it definitely makes the economics of grass-fed beef work much better.
Right.
The problem that we bump into sometimes is people will be like, well, there's just simply not enough arable land in the United States in order to raise enough grass-fed beef to feed the country. And I have a problem with that, because that's a very industrial agricultural way to describe our land use.
I did a little poking around on this, and there was once a bison herd in the United States that was as large as our current CAFO system. And it had been here for quite a while, you know, somewhere between 6,000 years, if you're on one end of the theological spectrum, maybe billions of years, you know, before that. Sure. And folks like Alan Savory, Joel Salatin, you know, they possibly upwards of 2/3 of the landmass that humans could occupy may be appropriate for nothing but grazing animals.
Right. And then there's also, that doesn't even bring into question the stuff like, you know, like Joel does at Polyface, where you've got different animals that are all using the same land. So for example, the steer that I bought from Chris at Chafin Family Orchards back in the day, yes, that was a grass-fed steer, but it was grazed in an olive orchard. So if you were looking at the land use of that particular, you know, plot of land, it's an orchard. It's growing olive trees. But what they did was they run the beef herd through the olive trees. And what that does is that prunes, you know, that trims down the grass that would otherwise grow up between the olive trees. So they're actually using the animal, instead of, you know, putting it on dedicated pasture to grow, they're using it to eat what the ranch or what the olive folk consider a waste product, i.e. all the grass between. And then they'd send those cattle through, and then they'd also send through goats who would eat shrubs that are wild pollinated and want to grow up from you know, in between the trees too. Because like another big problem they had there was blackberry bushes would grow up and choke out the trees in about 3 weeks if you left them to their own devices. So they'd send through cattle to eat the grass. They'd send through goats to eat the bushes and the shrubbery, right? And the goats would also climb up around in the trees, believe it or not. They were tree climbing goats. And they would, you know, prune the bottom, you know, 6 feet of branches or so, which isn't another job that a guy would have to do if they didn't use animals to do it. And instead of paying a guy and instead of paying a tractor or buying a tractor and then paying for fuel for the tractor, they send through livestock. And that's, you know, that, so instead of a net carbon sink on that, they have a net carbon, you know, output on that. They actually, you know, saved some fossil fuel inputs by doing that.
And potentially much more than what we're even aware of yet, because that's re-nutrifying the soil, increasing the microbiome in the soil, fixing carbon to the soil, creating nitrogen-fixing ecosystems in the soil, that the grass isn't being sprayed with Roundup to knock it back. So there's a lot. Fascinatingly, it seems like almost a more economical system, and I have this kind of wacky faith in evolution, having figured out a lot of very, very thrifty ways of dealing with things.
Yeah.
So that's where my heart kind of goes to this. Well, just to shift gears a little bit, recently watched or listened to the very successful and popular podcast Startup, and the very first episode involved this guy pitching his wife, hey, I'm going to start a company. I've got a super cush job with National Public Radio. I'm very well known in this scene. I'm going to quit my job. We have one kid on the way, and I'm going to quit my job and start a podcast company from scratch. And he throws this out to his wife. His wife is just appalled. And so what was the pitch to your wife about this project?
Oh my gosh. My wife is the most patient woman on the planet. Basically what I said was, so she saw my browser history. She saw an inordinate number of agricultural links. And then I said, so she's like, what are you looking at, you know, ranching for? And I said, so I think I want to buy a cow. And then there was just this stunned silence for a minute. But, you know, she knows me. She's known me for 10 years now. And I occasionally do ludicrous things.
And so she regrets nine of those years.
Right? No, dude, totally. And so she kind of looked at me and she's like, okay. And then I had to explain it. And then I had to go into the ifs and buts about the whole thing. And she took a day and she considered it. And then she's like, so you'd cook this? And I was like, yeah. And then she's like, and you would cook this for me? And I'm like, yeah. And she goes, and how long would this last? And I was like, oh, you know, year and a half. As an aside, it wound up lasting almost 5.
Wow.
Yeah, right. And then she finally, you know, she took a day and I didn't push it because, you know, that would not end well for anybody. And finally she said, okay, go get your cow. And I was like, okay, but now I gotta drive, you know, 9 hours and pick it up and blow a weekend on it. And she's like, geez, are you really? And then so that was another conversation that, you know, I'm gonna be gone and I'm gonna leave the boy and the dog with you for a weekend while I scamper up to Northern California with a buddy to go romp in olive orchards. But she eventually relented, and then we had to buy a freezer, because it's a lot of beef. It's 420 pounds of beef. And there was a little bit of time after we brought the thing home that I was, I had some serious consternation that I had misjudged the size of the freezer, which I don't recommend, because say you buy like 5 pounds of beef, right? And then you misjudge by, you know, 10%, you know, you're only gonna have 10% of 5 pounds. That's not really that much beef. You know, that's not really a whole lot of area. Like, oh, I've got 10% waste. If you buy 420 pounds of beef and you misjudge the size of your freezer by 10%, you're staring at 42 pounds of wasted beef. So yeah, and it was June and I was in the backyard with, you know, hockey pucks of beef scattered all around me, and it turned into a thing. But eventually, with a little beef Tetris, we got everything to fit. It was a scary afternoon.
Okay, so do you remember what your first meal was when you dug into this?
Totally, New York strip steak.
New York strip steak. So that was just an easy one. You probably, as you were doing your Tetris, you just made sure the strip steak stayed out on top. What was the accompaniment with that?
See, you say that like a smart person. What? No, I didn't do that at all. I finally got the thing to fit in there, and then I was like, all right, so now we need to get out a New York strip steak. Long pause. Staring. If we had to repack 420 pounds of beef 3 times. So I stood there and I looked at it. I was like, I am a mental giant. I can't believe and so I had to dig there. And of course they were on the bottom. They were under a 5.5 pound standing rib roast. So I had to like dig all the way down to the bottom. It delayed dinner for an hour. So anyway, but yes, so I eventually got there. We did it really simply on the grill, nice sear to medium rare. Grass-fed beef, a lot of people don't know, cooks faster than corn-fed beef because it doesn't have the same intramuscular fat, doesn't have the same marbling. And so we did that with roasted broccoli and a nice Pinot Noir.
Nice. That sounds amazing.
It was pretty good. It was late on a Sunday because we'd driven 9 hours, visited the ranch, and then driven 9 hours back. So it was one of the better meals that I've had. I think, you know, hunger is the best sauce.
Absolutely. So did you? So we've bought several half cows. We've never done a full cow. We've done several half cows. So we did learn that the things that we, you know, we would squirrel some strip steaks and ribeyes and stuff over on the side, and then more of the roasts and the bones that we make bone broth out of, they end up going in the bottom. And so there is a little bit of a plan that occurs, but it's hilarious for my wife and I. I do the bulk of the cooking, but my wife, I do B+ cooking, but it takes me like 10 minutes to get the whole meal done. My wife does A+ cooking, but it takes 6 hours, and the kitchen looks like a demilitarized zone afterwards. So it's impossible for her to clean up. You know, it's just a disaster.
Yeah.
But I will go in and basically whatever is on top, and it doesn't matter if it's like, spinal column or whatever. I'm like, okay, that's what's on top, and that's what I'm going to figure out something to make today. My wife will look in her cookbook, find something that she wants to make, and then it becomes the scavenger hunt through the freezer, and this thing is sub-zero, so you've got to put gloves on or you end up with frostbite by the time you rifle through it all. How did you tackle that? Did you have a dedicated plan, or did you start just, literally foraging in there and grab whatever was on top and then fixing that?
I'm a little between the two of you. Okay. So when I cook, I used to work in a restaurant once upon a time. I was a front of the house though. So I was a waiter. I wasn't one of the guys who, you know, did the actual work. But when I put together my mise en place in the kitchen, I'm pretty locked down. So I cook like you, I do all my prep. I've got everything sorted. And by the time it's go time, I'm a machine. And so everything happens. I didn't come to that, easily. I used to cook a lot more. I've referred to the technique as Schrodinger's kitchen, where you blow the place up and then, you know, the meal is simultaneously ruined and sublime, and you don't know until the end when the wave function collapses and you figure out whether you screwed it up or not. So I found out that I like to pull the variables out. Now, in terms of addressing the freezer, I did both. So my goal with this process was to make the absolute best use of every part of the animal that I possibly could. So I did a lot of research beforehand. I'd go back there and be like, what's a tri-tip really about, you know? So then I'd go and I'd research what a tri-tip was. And then I'd, you know, figure out six ways from Sunday, the best, you know, tri-tip reacts this way when you treat it this way, and it reacts that way when you treat it that way. So because of its, you know, because it has a fair amount of connective tissue in it, I'm going to want to do X, Y, or Z or whatever. So I went like that with every single piece. And then once I started getting better at that, and I was like, okay, so a chuck roast, I'm going to braise this thing. You know, I've got this brisket, I'm going to smoke it, I'm going to do this low and slow because it's got a lot of connective tissue, yada, yada. Eventually, I was like, all right, let's see. I don't know what this is. Let's see how I can, let's take a look at this, and let's just look at the meat itself and see if I can figure out something to do with that. So I just pick up like a sirloin tip or tip steak or something like that. And I'd be like, this looks like it's X, Y, or Z. And then, you know, I'd treat it the way I thought it should work. And then, you know, judge whether I was correct or not in the execution. And about half the time I was right. And about half the time I did some terrible, terrible things.
So what was the most successful meal that you feel like you pulled off, either, you know, with some great pre-planning or just some, you know, inspiration or just a stupid luck? Like what was the best meal that you pulled off?
Oh my gosh. I think one of the best that I did was a little bit of a combination of both of those things. I called it the Christmas Festa Kwanzaa feast. I didn't really, so I'm one of the, but both summer, my wife and I, our family lives 2,000 miles away. So it was our first holiday where we were going to spend Christmas here, because we didn't, you know, my son was getting old enough to ask about Santa Claus, and we didn't want to have to explain, you know, well, sometimes Santa Claus comes to grandma and grandpa's. So we decided to stay home, but we've got a lot of Kansas friends out here. We've got a lot of film school friends who are, you know, we call them the Kansas expats. And so we had a big, you know, most of them were not going home to Kansas either. So we did a big feast where we had all of them over. And I was just like, okay, you know, there might be a little homesickness here, so we're going to blow the doors off this thing. So I did a standing rib roast. I did it in seven courses. So I started with, you know, a nice appetizer, and then I moved into like a Caesar salad made from scratch with, you know, coddled egg tableside, and then I moved into a little palate cleanser of a peach grapefruit granada, and then I moved into the main course, which was the standing rib roast done, you know, as prime rib, except it's not prime technically, yada yada, because that's a USDA designation, right? So it did basically prime rib with Yorkshire pudding, and then did a cherries Jubilee at the end of it, which we got to set on fire, which, you know, if you know film school kids, setting stuff on fire is a big plus.
Oh, hey, I'm a chemist. So that's one area of it. That's where that Venn diagram overlaps. Yeah, fire is good. So that sounds amazing. The one thing that I have not been able to figure out with the cow are kidneys.
Yeah. Kidneys, yeah. No, they didn't give me the kidneys. I wish they would have.
Because
what they did was they had to dry age the beef. So they keep the kidneys out because it's attached to the suet, which is used as a fat cap to when they dry age the thing. So I didn't actually get those. I know, same thing. I don't know how to do kidneys.
I've done just about everything, but the kidneys taste like pee, no matter what.
Really?
I've done to them.
So, oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Have you done hanger steak?
We've done hanger steak. We do a pretty slick beef heart chili where we use beef heart and liver, and you can't go overboard on the liver. It's usually about 4 or 5 parts beef heart for 1 part liver, but I cut the stuff up into, you know, not the decent sized chunks, and then I throw that into a food processor, basically get it to the consistency of ground beef, and then you make your either a classic chili, or we've been playing around with like a Mediterranean seasoning chili with like allspice and garam masala and stuff like that, and it's turned out great. Yeah.
So you do the heart and a braise then?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, how cool! I haven't done that.
Yeah.
I did it. I made the beef heart comes in two halves when you buy the whole thing, and so I did one half as antichuchos, which are like Peruvian mm-hmm. skewered things. I did that for my wife on Valentine's Day.
Nothing says heart like heart,
right? That's what I thought. I was alone in that assessment.
not alone anymore. We're there. But.
But then the second thing I did was I did it as tartare. If you have the opportunity to do it tartare, that's fantastic. That blew the doors off. We really lucked out on that. We did a tartare puttanesca thing. So we had all the puttanesca flavors with the capers and the garlic and the onions. And it was diced really fine. It had some olive oil. It was really lovely.
So how about beef tongue? I've had some wins on that and I've had some epic failures.
We did that as lengua tacos.
Okay.
And yeah, do that. That one works out. So basically what you do is you make a broth, or you do it basically as a braise, and then you braise it with a lot of onions and a lot of garlic, and you braise it forever, and then you pull it, and then you remove it from the braise, let it cool for 5 or 10 minutes till you can handle it. And then I actually had to sanitize some pliers, which was something I can say I've done now. So you sanitize some pliers, and then you pull the outer casing of the tongue off, and all the taste buds and all the weird textury stuff comes off in one kind of fell swoop. And then you dice, and then you slice that into, it's always nice when you braise to have a sear. So you dice, you slice it into big slices, and then you sear it on either side, and then you dice it from those slices, and it turns out really, really nice.
It took me one go of not peeling the taste buds off that I realized that was a huge tactical
error. Oh, no.
We'll save all this stuff and just run with it. And that was a disaster.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, that. What was it like? It's chewy, right?
It's well, you knew that something had been using those papillary structures for tasting something at some point.
So yeah.
It was a bit more intimate than even I was comfortable with. I've eaten some really funky stuff, but that was a tough one, and I ended up eating all of that because Nikki was just like, yeah, this is all you.
What blew me away on that is that there is the texture. Like when you rub it, it's kind of like a cat's tongue where you mm-hmm. goes one direction and it's rough and the other direction it's smooth. It's because the cows actually use their tongues as prehensile limbs to pull grass up out of the ground when they eat it.
Yeah. And that prehensitility was very evident when I made that
taco. Oh, dude, I'm sorry you had to go through that.
Well, you know, you live and learn. And now that just goes in my bone broth mix, which is that something that you guys did? Did you have a lot of the spinal column and all that and do some bone broth, or how did you treat all the bones and connective tissue and whatnot?
We didn't have any spinal column because we're not allowed to. Basically, when you take home a whole animal, you're not allowed to bring home any of the lungs or any of the spinal tissue. So no head, no spine, no lungs. And that's because the processor is concerned about mad cow disease, which hasn't been a problem in grass fed, but it's still a thing. So we had plenty of femoral bones. So we had lots of marrow bones sliced up, and we used a fair bit of them. First of all, we did. Fergus Henderson has a really famous dish he does where he slices it. He roasts the marrow bones and then serves it with a salad of parsley and shallots, and that is magical. I was like, oh, it's just gonna be marrow bone and shallots. I'm sure that'll be delicious and everything. No, it's insane. It's absolutely madness. And it really is God's butter. And then the other thing we did with this is, yes, we did use it, and we used it to make stock. And that was probably the single most, single biggest up to my culinary game that I did. And it took me an embarrassingly long time to do it because I was so busy making roast marrow bones to eat, by themselves.
Right.
And then I was like, and then I was like, why would I ever give these to the dog? What was I thinking? Anyway, long story short, I eventually got around. I was like, I need to make stock. So I made stock, and then that just makes everything better. I mean, it's so easy to buy stock in the store, but the stuff you make at home is more nutritious and has a bigger depth of flavor. And that was probably the biggest improvement that I managed to make.
Yeah, and I've done that for ages, whether it was a chicken or turkey or whatever. I had always just thrown all the fiddly bits into a Ziploc bag, throw that in the freezer. Once the gallon Ziploc bag is full, then I have like a 8-quart pressure cooker. And so I would throw all that stuff in there, and then I would get 4 to 6 quarts of water into that, and I was set. And I had always used that, but definitely within the Weston A. Price paleo primal scene, like the, you know, the bone broth soup stock deal has become very popular. And
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And my stuff comes out basically jelly. Like once it cools off in the fridge, yeah, I actually have to scoop it out. The stuff does not pour.
Yeah, a lot of gelatin in there. That's great.
Yeah.
Do you roast them first? Do you roast them before you put them in?
I do. Yeah. So the dog, my father-in-law actually lives about 6 houses up from us, and his dog does get those shin bones and whatnot, but it's after they've been roasted and typically pressure cooked twice. And so the dog still enjoys them, but I'm sure she would enjoy them much more if she got them straight out of the
kitchen. Yeah, totally. Yeah, you guys have extracted a lot from that. That's great.
Yeah. So, Jared, the folks that listen to the podcast, they're typically pretty geeked on performance, health, longevity stuff. I'm trying to meter out this idea of sustainability in bite-sized doses so that people aren't freaked out by it. What's the year of the cow gonna give to folks if they want to buy the book and read it, if they want to get it for somebody they know? Like, I feel like this book could be a gateway book to much better eating and much better understanding about where our food comes from. What's your take on that? Like, what's your elevator pitch for why somebody wants to get Year of the Cow?
Yeah, well, basically what I learned about this is, you know, this started when I wanted to make the best use of an animal that I possibly could. I come from a family of hunters, and that's sacred. You know, when you take a deer, you know, you're going to make the best use of every part of that animal that you possibly could, because an animal died for that meal. So you don't hunt more than you need, and you make good use of what you have. So that's what I wanted to do with this cow. And so then I that taught me how to cook, and then that taught me how to that taught me a lot about gastronomy and a lot about agriculture. And then when I was considering it, it became, you know, I started asking myself, what does it mean to make the best use of this animal that I possibly could? If I eat this grass-fed cow, right, if I eat this grass-fed steer, and I use the energy the metabolic energy that it gives me, and I go and I, you know, play video games for 4 hours, am I making the best use of that animal that I possibly can? If I go and I, you know, mindlessly surf the channels for, you know, 2 hours, am I making the best use of that animal that I possibly can? And that's the other side that this forced me to confront, and I didn't expect it at all. So I wound up saying, well, how can I make the best use of this animal that I possibly could? And it made, you know, first of all, am I as healthy as I could be? And, you know, as I researched that and I came to your work and I came to the work of Mark Sisson and, you know, a number of other people, and it occurred to me that, no, I'm not. And what I really loved about your book is that you gave me the why behind the what you should do, but your geek facts and your why you should do that was fantastic. And that was like manna to me. And so I said, well, how did people, you know, I was exploring how things used to happen. And I was like, how did people used to run? Because I've always been something of a runner. Mm. And, you know, that got me into barefoot running. And I started running more. And then I, you know, got in probably the best shape of my life as a result of, you know, doing what everybody, you know, buying a grass-fed steer, which everybody thought would be, you know, a gigantic death sentence for me because red meat is evil, yada, yada. And so from that, I started, you know, getting outside more. I started getting in way better shape, and then I wound up getting, you know, my mental space got a lot better because, you know, I realized in doing this and getting out in the world that, you know, what am I really focusing on and what should I be focusing on? So I started doing a lot more out, you know, camping and hiking. I wound up summiting the tallest mountain in the contiguous 48 states twice. Well, wow. once was an attempt, and then the second time was successful. I run more than I've ever run in my life now. I feel better. I have much better energy. I really pay a lot more attention to what I give my attention to, if that is not too meta for you. But, yeah, it made me question a lot of, like, you know, how we live, why we live that way, and how we should.
Ah, it's amazing. And all from just buying a grass-fed cow.
Yeah, it surprised me too.
It's totally amazing. Jared, what was the last meal that you made?
Tail.
Tail. The oxtail. What did you do with that?
We braised it.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. We braised it and made a nice little braise. It came with it. You know, when you have it, there's a lot of connective tissue in the tail, and we braised it and then reduced it into a sauce.
Fantastic.
Yeah, because we made some hay of the fact, no pun intended, that we were actually eating it nose to literally tail.
Right.
And so yeah, we thought tail was the appropriate last thing to do.
Oh, that's smart. Well, yeah. And clearly the tail probably went on the bottom of the freezer, so that made it easier too.
You know, odds are good. Everything went on the bottom. Whatever I happened to be looking for that day, I'll bet it was on the bottom.
Right.
Yeah, I'm that's just the way I rolled. I made some logistical errors packing that beef into a freezer.
Ah, details. So how long did it take between that and the reorder?
I haven't actually done the reorder yet. I need to do that. But no, I haven't actually gotten around to doing that yet. But yeah, it's definitely coming.
That's awesome. Well, Jared, I was really tickled that Chris introduced us at the Savory Institute gig. I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book. It was very enjoyable. My daughter Zoe was just fascinated with the cover. And, you know, we've been, even though she's quite young, we've tried to be very transparent with her about, you know, life, death, circle of life, you know, Lion King type stuff. And it's just the cover with the cow kind of partitioned out, you know, with the seasons. She practices her letters with that because they're all in capitals. And then
that's great.
Yeah, so we did that for a couple of weeks, and while I was reading the book. And then also she has asked me each time I cook dinner, she says, Dad, which part of the cow is this? And then I would go over and try to figure out, okay, so there on the cow, you know, is where it's at. And you see some, you know, some real depth of understanding. We were on a walk the other day, and there was a rabbit that had been hit by a car.
Right.
She's like, Dad, that rabbit's dead. And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, that's too bad. And then we walked for a while, and she said, Dad, a coyote will probably eat that rabbit. And I was like, it probably will.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and that's a three-year-old kid really getting some, I think, some pretty deep life lessons right out of the gate, you know. And
yeah.
So your book has been useful to my family for both learning on a variety of levels. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm really glad to hear that. Yeah, it's we had similar experiences with my son, and you know, and my daughter. We haven't yet, but I'm sure we will. You know, you have to have. It's always sad to have that conversation about, like, well, yeah, that animal is dead, and then no, it's not going to get better, but something else will get better as a result of it, because, you know, it's better to have that moment of sadness, I suppose, than it is to have them blithely assuming that the, you know, the world exists solely for their nurture and comfort.
Right,
so,
right. Although you guys did bail on family to perpetuate the fantasy of Santa Claus, but, you know, not perfect.
There is that. Nobody's perfect, I suppose.
Well, Jared, where can people track you down and learn more about all this?
Absolutely. You can find me at yearofthecow.com. And also I'm on Twitter as YOTC for Year of the Cow, YOTC Jared. And I'm on Facebook at YOTC Jared as well.
Awesome. Well, Jared, just again, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for sharing it with me and my family. And I'm excited for the folks that listen to the podcast to check this out. It was just a very enjoyable read and very educational.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Well, take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
You as well, man. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.